Good evening, everyone. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see you.
Good. Hello, Donna. Thank you for all your support.
Happy to have you here. So everything we can do to make it easy for you, we'll do it.
Okay, good.
Okay.
All right. This was my little thing to my headset wasn't working. I was going, well, I'm not hearing everyone so well. So anyway, but you can hear me all right, I assume. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. Let's go ahead and start then, Donna. I'll turn it over to you to do the prayers then.
Okay. Let's see, here we are. And let's do the Seven Limb Prayer in English again. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And tonight, let's chant Refuge in Bodhicitta in Tibetan, all three times. Sangye chodang so ki chognam la jang tu bardu dag mi kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi pe sonam gi dro la pin shir sangye dru par sho. Sangye chodang so ki chognam la jang tu bardu dag mi kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi pe sonam gi dro la pin shir sangye dru par sho. Sangye chodang so ki chognam la jang tu bardu dag mi kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi pe sonam gi dro la pin shir sangye dru par sho.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Donna. As usual, let's start with a short meditation, give ourselves a chance to focus the mind a bit, and then on the basis of that, we'll do a short guided meditation to refresh our motivation of bodhicitta for these teachings. Bodhicitta, of course, is going to come up a lot this weekend because this is a particular text in the Mahayana tradition where we are working with the practices of a bodhisattva. So let's go ahead and just do a few minutes of focused meditation on the breath, and no doubt you have techniques that you already work with in terms of the breath, and one of those you can choose to use. If you need a suggestion, as usual, I generally suggest working with the area around the nostrils, especially in the evening or, you know, later in the day. It's kind of a nice one because it sort of brings the mind up a little bit with the attention in this area. So you're just kind of focusing into the sensation that occurs as you breathe in and out through the nose, and wherever that's occurring, just try to stay present with that, not letting the mind wander as best as you can. But no doubt the mind will get distracted. This is something we'll also be touching on this weekend. But when that happens, when we see that that's occurred, we simply adjust that, bringing the mind back to the breath, letting go of whatever it was that distracted us. So even if you have to do this a number of times over the next few minutes, that's perfectly fine. So I'll ring the chime to begin the meditation period. Again, a few minutes in silence, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection. So now let's set our motivation of bodhicitta. You know, this mind is said to be the most powerful mind that we can bring to our practice. It has the greatest virtue because the scope of this mind is all sentient beings. But before we get to all sentient beings, it's always wise to simply start with ourselves to generate the compassion and loving thoughts that are a part of bodhicitta towards ourselves. So just take a moment to really embrace yourself in terms of your own experience in this life. And if you have conviction in past lives, no doubt, all the various things of samsara, sufferings and so on, we've experienced in one lifetime or another. But just take in particular, you know, even just where you're at right now. We're living in truly trying times, difficult times. And just hold yourself within the thought of first acknowledging that this is a moment of suffering that we're thinking about. This is a life of suffering we're thinking about. We can see in our own existence how we do suffer at a grosser level as well as the subtler levels that the Buddha taught. So that first step is simply just holding yourself in that awareness of your own suffering, sort of validating it. And then the next thought is to open up to the universality of that, that this is a shared condition among human beings, among beings in samsara. And what we are experiencing is part of the larger picture of all sentient beings suffering. This is just to give us that sort of connection with others. We're not going to yet focus on others, but just to recognize that we're not alone in our predicament. Our own individual situation might be quite unique, but nonetheless, what we find ourselves in terms of the general status, the general state, isn't different. We're like all other beings. This is part of our shared humanity, our shared sentient beingness. And then begin to generate thoughts of compassion and loving kindness towards yourself within the space of understanding and validating your own suffering, seeing that it is part of the bigger picture that all beings are experiencing. Holding thoughts of wishing for yourself to be free from that, wishing for you to know that true freedom and to know, moreover, the greatest level of happiness. And just do this in your own language. Just generate these thoughts towards yourself, seeing that you are a being that is worthy of compassion, worthy of loving kindness, without a doubt. And then from that space of recognizing your own good heart, having generated these thoughts towards yourself, begin to expand that out to others. And you can start with those that it's quite easy to think of in these terms. Others who are very dear to you, close to you. Just generate these same thoughts towards them. May they be happy. May they be free from suffering. May they know true peace. Whatever words you use. It should be quite easy to do this towards those who we feel quite close to. And then take it out another degree by thinking about all the other beings that we don't know in this world, that we haven't developed a relationship with, but who are kind of behind the scenes, what we call the strangers of this life. And see how they too are in the same predicament. They want to be happy, don't want to suffer. They are caught up in the same predicament that we find ourselves in. May they be happy. May they be free from all their suffering. And then finally, see if we can expand this to include the most challenging people in our lives, those who have harmed us or those that we love, or who hold, you know, political views or are doing actions that we are opposed to, or whatever it is, you know, in the larger scene of things, but also in our own societies, our families, anyone who we feel some aversion towards. See that they're in the same boat as you. Moreover, they really need our love and compassion to try to cut through so much of what they do, their mindset. Try to generate the thoughts of wishing them to be happy and to be free completely of all suffering. These beings who are difficult for us were in that state, they would no longer be difficult for anyone. And then see if you can channel these thoughts into a wish to take responsibility for this. To think that I can't leave this up to these beings alone. I will take responsibility for helping them on this path, leading them to freedom from suffering, the fulfillment of their happiness and well-being. I will do this for them. And we can feel motivated in doing that because we see that we are connected to these beings. These beings have shown us kindness in this lifetime to some degree, but in countless lifetimes, we have depended upon these beings in a variety of ways. So really feel your heart open to them with a sincere wish to benefit them, to actually become the cause to help them. And think then that the only way to do this perfectly is to work on ourselves fully, to become a Buddha ourselves, so that in that state of full awakening, we then can help other beings perfectly, having a mind that knows all, knows especially the minds of other beings, their karma, and so on. And moreover, the compassion that wishes to benefit them fully developed, the love that wants to place them in happiness fully developed, and the power, the skillful means to know exactly how to help them. This is the state we want to attain. This is the goal of bodhicitta, the mind of awakening that seeks to fulfill our own potential so we can help others to do the same. And actually hold the thought of your attaining that state and being able to lead all beings to that exact same state, sort of thinking about the resultant scene after all of this is done. You know, all beings in that state. This is what we're aiming for. Not a single being left behind. And it's with this motivation that we're going to engage in this precious text that will help us to develop our minds in that direction. Hey, again, welcome to tonight's session, which is the first session in this course on How to Live in Compassion is the title we gave it, the Bodhisattva's Jewel Garland, which is a wonderful little text. It's not so long, but there's a lot to it. Nonetheless, as I was preparing over the last few days, I was reminded of how much there was to this text, but I have confidence that we will get through most of it. And if not, I'll do it in Tibetan style, you know, or when you get to like the last session, you go through the verses really, really quickly with only like a sentence of commentary, so which will be fine. But so let's get into the text. Just so you know, that the text itself, which I'm using Thupten Jinpa's translation, was available. Donna kindly put it out on Kadampa Center's website, and so where you went to register for this, you can find it there, and you can just, you know, print it out. I don't think you have to have gone through the whole registration to get it. I think it's right there on the page, so you can find it there and print that out for yourself. I'm also going to be putting the verses up on the screen as we go through it. But tonight we're going to start with sort of an introduction to the text, because this text does have a few things to say about it before we actually get into it, just so you have sort of the historical context as well as the context for it in terms of the Buddha's teachings and what have you. So in terms of the introduction tonight, this part of it, we will get into verses tonight. I have no doubt that we will. I want to talk about the author of the text, who's we generally call Lama Atisha, Atisha Dipamkara Srinyana, and then the context of these teachings, how do they fit into the corpus of what the Buddha taught, especially the Lam Rim presentation that Atisha is also known for, and then the text itself, just a brief introduction to what we're going to be looking at to kind of give you an overview of the text. It is an interesting text because it, again, is these small little verses without a whole lot of structure to it per se. I mean, there's a number of topics taught about, but the structure is not really quite as evident. And so, and I haven't really figured out any particular structure, but I want to talk about what the text consists of. So the author, many of you are familiar with Atisha, Dipamkara Srinyana. The Atisha is known once more as the person who came to Tibet and brought along what's called the Lam Rim tradition, as well as kind of initiating the Kadam, which Kadampa Center is named after, the sort of Kadam lineage. So let me give just a little bit of background on Lama Atisha. This is one photo or tanka that I found of him, not a photo, a tanka image that I found of him on the internet. By the way, the retreats that Kadampa Center generally hosts over at the Blue Ridge Mountain Assembly in September, August, sometimes they were in May, but there's going to be one next September, not this year because of COVID-19. Hopefully, make prayers for that to happen. They've been based on that Lam Rim text that is the initial text that Atisha taught. Of course, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, in his normal teaching style, only has opened up the text once or twice, I think, twice maybe, Donna, something like that. Yeah, something. So anyway, but know that Lama Atisha, again, is sort of the, not quite progenitor, but he's certainly the one of the key figures. But he came, you know, into Tibet at a time when Buddhism was already established. Buddhism was established somewhere around the 6th, 7th century. Teachings began coming in. Shantarakshita and Padmasambhava, you know, sort of got the Dharma a little more settled within Tibet and started the monastic lineage there. But, you know, it had kind of waned to some degree. And so this is where Atisha comes into the scene. Again, his dates were from around 982 to 1054, so roughly 1,000 years ago. He was living and studying and eventually making his way over to Tibet. But the story of Lama Atisha, he, you know, grew up very much like the Buddha in a wealthy family and decided to pursue a spiritual life. I could go through the whole biography, but it's not what I really want to do with the time we have. There's a wonderful new biography. Last year this was published by James B. Apple, who's actually doing a little talk tonight for the folks back in the center I used to study at, say, Chenling out in San Francisco. But he's written this wonderful biography and translated a number of the texts, including the text that we're going to be studying this weekend. I'll reference that in a moment. But again, he started studying, and he became more and more aware of the whole Mahayana lineage, which is, of course, what Tibetan Buddhism is a part of. He grew up in India, though. He wasn't a Tibetan. He went to Vikramashila Monastery is where he ended up doing most of his studies. But during his studies, at page 16 of James Apple's biography, he says, during his studies, Atisha continually thought about the quickest path to reach Buddhahood. And one time he went to visit his guru, Rahula Gupta Vajra, who was dwelling in the caves of the Black Mountain. Rahula Gupta Vajra, through his supersensory powers, told Atisha that even if one has a direct vision of a chosen deity, witnesses many assemblies of mandala deities, or attains many common accomplishments or siddhis, even if you do all these amazing, fantastic things, one's practice will not go anywhere unless it is based on the awakening mind, bodhicitta, comprised of love and compassion. This is why, of course, we meditate on this at the beginning of all of our classes. A bit of what I did tonight in leading the meditation was to bring that mind to bear, because if we don't, no matter what we do in our spiritual path, if it's divorced of that mind and bodhicitta, it will not bring forth the fruit that we are seeking. So Rahula Gupta Vajra instructed Atisha to hold the great compassionate one, Avalokiteshvara, as his preferred deity in order to benefit beings. His name is going to come up shortly when we talk about the praise, as well as get into some other aspects of this practice. But on another occasion, while circumambulating the main temple at Vajrasana, the Mahabodhi temple in modern-day Bodh Gaya, Atisha overheard two women speaking about the one method to quickly attain awakening. One woman asked, "What is that one method?" The other replied, "You should train in the awakening mind." Along a stone wall that had been built by Acharya Nagarjuna, he overheard an older woman tell a younger woman that if one wishes to attain full awakening quickly, one should train in the awakening mind. So he's like, it's like, you know, you're hearing it in many different places. It sort of starts to hit home that this is what you need to be looking at. Atisha, having overheard these discussions on the awakening mind, made a commitment to produce this precious altruistic resolution and to expand and increase the awakening mind until he attained full awakening. Atisha then began to seek out a qualified teacher who completely possessed the special instructions on how to fully actualize the awakening mind. So this is where the story gets interesting, because he's in India and he makes this 13-month journey to Indonesia to study with a great master known as Sir Lingpa. And Sir Lingpa became one of his most precious gurus. He had three main root gurus. He had 200 and some odd, 70 or so other gurus that played a role in his spiritual development. But Sir Lingpa always held a very special place, because Sir Lingpa was holding the lineage of all the teachings that came from the Buddha pertaining to developing awakening mind. Oftentimes we talk about kind of the two wings of a bird and the two major lineages of teachings, or the teachings of the profound, which pertain to the wisdom of emptiness and all the wisdom teachings that the Buddha gave. And there's the teachings of the vast, which means the diverse teachings that the Buddha gave on all the other practices that support the development all the way to Buddhahood. And we need both of these. We need the wing of wisdom and we need the wing of compassion. And together with both of those, we will fly to, you know, the goal of enlightenment, the island of enlightenment. But there is a third lineage that is why Atisha went there to see Sir Lingpa and to study with him and obtain this lineage. And this is what is often referred to as the practice lineage. And specifically, it refers to what has come to be known as the corpus of the Buddha's teachings we refer to as Lojong, or thought transformation, which I'll talk about again a little bit later. But Lama Atisha came back with this richness of teachings, having gotten full exposure to everything involved in developing the awakening mind, cultivating it in every activity, making it very, very practical. And the gist of it is that, you know, he became a great practitioner within India, but in Tibet they heard about him. And the little story, I won't go into all the details, it's told in most of the Lam Rim texts, such as Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, which is the one we generally use in the FPMT to study for the first time, at least, our sort of stages of the path, the Lam Rim, the way that the path to enlightenment is set out. But the story of Lama Atisha is essentially that he was invited into Tibet, and there were all these little, you know, ways of maneuvering to be able to get him to actually come. And he was told through an appearance of his deity that he would actually lose a portion of his life by going to Tibet. He would sacrifice some 20 years of his life if he went to Tibet. But then the deity told him, but it would also be very, very favorable if you were to go. It would be very good for the Dharma. So he said, well, you know, the benefit sounds good. I might lose 20 years of my life, but, you know, hey, it's just one life, you know, let's go for it. So he made the long journey over into the Tibetan plateau. And of course, in Tibet, he became very revered, was asked to write this very first text on the Lam Rim that's called Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, and developed sort of that whole corpus of teachings. And this text was also, I don't know if this was composed in Tibet, I think it was composed prior to that, but Lama Atisha sort of became the forerunner of all of the teachings on this Kadam lineage, or this practical practice lineage that he learned from Lama Sir Lingpa. So let's go ahead and go back to the screen. I want to, you know, leave Lama Atisha behind. There's, again, much more that you could find in that biography. Thank you, Donna, for putting the title of that, full title of that, into the chat box. Again, the context of these teachings then, and I put the covers of the two books that are sort of where you find Lama Atisha's main teaching that I just mentioned, The Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. It's got some wonderful teachings by Geshe Sonam Rinchen. And of course, the way that the Lam Rim is set out in there is only in about four or five verses in terms of the structure of it. And then he goes on to talk a lot about bodhisattva vows and other things in there. But essentially, in the very first verses of that text, he sets out these sort of three stages of development. And when Venerable Rabina teaches on these, of course, she uses a wonderful analogy, as she's prone to do, which is kind of our education system, which for, I mean, you can have many different levels within, but let's talk about it in terms of elementary education, sort of intermediate education, which is sort of our high school, and then university level. Well, even at, if you have a child at 5 years old that you really want, you know, them to go to university, you don't take them at 5 years old to the university and drop them off and say, here, you know, go get your degree and, you know, come back when you're finished. You know, they can't go into university without having developed the skills first of elementary school and then fine-tuning those skills and knowledge through intermediate school and then being able to enter into university-level studies without too much difficulty. It's very much the same in terms of how Atisha set out this stages of the path. And many of you know these teachings, so I'm not going to go into great depth. But essentially, he said there are three levels of practice, depending upon the motivation that one brings and the sort of capacity that one has to practice at that level. The very first level is where we become aware of what's all going on in terms of we have this particular existence right now as a human being. But according to the Buddha's teachings, this is one of infinite existences that we've had prior to this. And those existences are there because we have a continuity of awareness, of consciousness, of mind that goes through all of those existences without any beginning. And so we are right now in this human life, but this human life is going to come to an end and our consciousness is going to go on to another existence. And we have to have some concern, some regard for what that existence will be. That's the first level of motivation and the first level of capacity. As Rinpoche would say, the small capable being, you know, you have only a bit of capability or capacity to practice. But the main teachings that are set out there, the main teachings that are set out there are pertaining to karma, to kind of how to take charge of that process by working on one's own actions. Karma will come up in these teachings this weekend because it is a part of the path and the main part of the path. And so Lama Atisha does address it at another point in the text. On the middle level, or what we call the person of the middling capacity, the middle capable being, as Rinpoche says, we look at the big picture and we go, okay, so I get a new life that's pretty good, but then I have to, that one I lose and I go on to another life, and then that one goes on, you know, and then I eventually have to take another life. You come to recognize that what we are involved in, the sort of cycle of life, this cyclic existence or samsara, in and of itself is unsatisfactory. You know, even if we get good experiences, good existences, you still have to age, you still have to die, you still have to get ill, you still have to be separated from all the things you love and face all the things that you don't want to. So there are a lot of things that make this existence unsatisfactory. At that second level, your motivation becomes, I want to break free of all of that. And that topic also will come up in the course of our teachings, what we call the striving for liberation, driven by the mind of renunciation, the mind that has determined that I'm tired of it all. I've been there, done that for way too long. I want to be free of it all. I want to attain the state of peace that we call nirvana. The third level of practice is the great scope or the person of greatest capacity, the great capable being. This is for the person who goes beyond just one's own concern. Those first two stages, first two levels, are where one focuses on one's own situation. It's self-compassion. This is how Lama Yeshe, founder of our organization, even framed it. This is compassion for yourself, really understanding your own suffering. On the basis of that, you then can translate that understanding to everyone else. And recognizing the connection we have to others, develop the mind of bodhicitta, and wish to kind of achieve a greater goal, to go beyond your own liberation to the state of enlightenment, the state of Buddhahood, a state in which you will then have all the perfect qualities to be able to help others. So this is, again, the structure for how he put out the Buddha's teachings. Now, within the great scope level, it's all of what I've talked about is what we would normally call the sutra teachings, the sort of common or general teachings that the Buddha gave. But an extension of the great scope are the tantric teachings, which it's also said that Lama Atisha, even though he didn't write much on tantra at all, I don't know that he wrote any specific tantric texts, but he's got tantric meanings behind some things in his texts, and we even get that a little bit in this text that we're going to study this weekend. Tantra is said to be for those who are intent upon achieving enlightenment even more quickly. You know, they are going to develop themselves if they can, and even in a single lifetime, to be able to fully accomplish Buddhahood. Because the sutra path is said to be one that actually takes quite a bit of time in the development of this mind over many, many lifetimes, and cultivating everything that's necessary so that you can achieve that state. But with the tantric path, as I mentioned the other night when we talked about Tara, you bring the result into the present moment and think of yourself in the form of that Buddha and develop yourself within that context that you've got Buddha nature, Buddha potential, and you're going to think of yourself as a Buddha right now. And of course, you do all the other things involved in the sutra path as well. But nonetheless, it's sort of an extension of the great scope, a way that we can, you know, achieve that result even more quickly. So know that, again, Lam Rim in general usually just sets out the sutra path for those three levels, and then you usually have Tantra as a separate corpus of teachings that kind of help you once you've got familiarity with the sutra path and developing yourself completely and doing that in a much quicker way. Within the great scope, though, is the other thing. I'll go ahead and put the back on the screen here, the other text that I mentioned. This is just the text that's on there isn't, you know, kind of the only text in the mind training lineage, but it is what's called the Great Collection of Mind Training Texts. This was published by Wisdom quite a few years ago, Wisdom Publications. Thupten Jinpa, who translated the text that we're looking at, translated it for that collection. The text that we are looking at is actually the very first text in this mind training collection, because as I said, it's said to be sort of the progenitor of all of these Lojong or mind training teachings. Lo in Tibetan means mind, jong means to train, transform, become familiar with, habituate. So all of Buddha's teachings are mind training in an essence, in a way. I mean, because we're not talking about changing the external world through our Buddhist practice. We're talking about changing our inner world. This is what it means to be a Buddhist, is to be an inner being, somebody who is intent upon changing one's own mind, transforming one's own mind. So Lojong, though, in particular, is a corpus, a genre of teachings that really is focused on that idea within the Mahayana lineage, within the idea of bodhicitta, and how we use everything we meet with bodhicitta motivation and bodhisattva thinking and action to transform all of that into a path to enlightenment. You know, one of the teachings that I've mentioned earlier in my teachings here that is very involved in this is the teaching on transforming our problems or difficulties into the path. We talked about a bit on Wednesday night in terms of the trying times that we're going through. How do we actually use these negative experiences as something very positive for us to help us to transform what would normally be painful and difficult into something that becomes the cause for happiness? So this is just one part of mind training, because mind training involves any of the trainings that are about practical instructions, taking what the Buddha taught and making it come to life in our lives. And this is, of course, what this text, the Bodhisattva's Jewel Garland, as I said, it's the very first text in that great collection. It's also found in the Book of Kadam. By the word, this whole word, by the way, this whole word kadam, actually the meaning of this, it's the two words in Tibetan, again, ka, meaning kind of the words, the teachings that the Buddha gave, and dam means practical instruction. So we see all the words of the Buddha as practical instructions. This is what the whole Kadampa lineage is about, is kind of taking all of that to heart and seeing, you know, what the Buddha taught as instructions for oneself about how to practice this path of awakening, how to develop one's mind in that direction. So in terms of the first part I talked about, the Lam Rim, there are three levels of development. When we get to the great level, this is where you would find normally these teachings on Lojong, on how to transform your mind. And they even get fed into, or kind of a part of, the one of the techniques for developing bodhicitta. And I'll touch on those when we get to that topic, probably tonight, a little bit later. So this is just the context for where these teachings fit in. They are not, you know, grade school level teachings. We're dealing with university level teachings here. So keep that in mind. And as we go through this, you know, don't feel like you have to practice all of this immediately. It's good to get exposed to these teachings, to take in what you can and to make it practical for you. But recognize that we will be touching on a lot of things that might seem like, you know, I'm not sure I can do that right now. That's okay. The third topic we're going to look at is just briefly introducing you to the text. That isn't the text, by the way. That's just a little copy or photo that I took from the internet of the Tibetan pecha. Pecha are the loose leaves of texts that are printed with wood blocks. Initially, that's how they were printed onto these loose leaves. And this is what a Tibetan who knows Tibetan language better than I do, obviously, would be able to, you know, read from that. But anyway, as I said, this text is mainly sutra, mainly covering the general teachings of the Buddha within the Mahayana, though it also touches on, you know, some of the other teachings of that lower scope, the middle scope, as well as, of course, the great scope. But it does have some tantric references here and there, which is kind of interesting. Again, and you don't, maybe they won't be evident immediately, but I'll point those out as we go through. There are only 26 verses in this text. You might think, well, with 26 verses, you can cover this tonight, right? Well, each verse is kind of very rich, and sometimes you even have within each verse two or three ideas. And these are said to be like a string of precious gems or jewels. And so I often, when I introduce this text, talk about it being like Buddhist fortune cookie sayings. And I actually think it would be wonderful if a center, I told our center here, but they didn't take me up on it, work with a fortune cookie company and like cut up all these little sayings that are part of the text. And you could like sell bags of fortune cookies with Satisha's jewel garland, you know, sayings within it. Because each of them is kind of worth meditating on. And you could certainly divide the text up yourself in terms of various things and then just use them day by day or week by week to practice some of these things more deeply. Again, we're going to use Thupten Jinpa's translation. Thupten Jinpa, if you don't know who he is the Dalai Lama's translator when the Dalai Lama teaches in English-speaking countries. Sometimes when he's in other countries, he'll have a translator who knows the native language of that country. But he's an amazing scholar in and of himself. He was a Geshe. He doesn't go by the title of Geshe Thupten Jinpa because they usually reserve that for monks and nuns now. There's the Geshe Mas, who are the female Geshes. He's an amazing scholar, and he's got a number of books out himself that he tends to focus a lot on these heart teachings as well. The order of the verses I have modified slightly per James Apple's version. I always wondered about this when I went through the text previously because I taught it in numerical order, but it always felt like it was a little different in the order than what it should be. And James Apple's translation actually seems to present another way of teaching the text. So I'm going to teach it that way. What you have in hand, though, is Thupten Jinpa's, which goes through the numerical order. But there's only two places where I take some text, some verses, and kind of move them around. And so you'll see that, and it'll be clear as we go through this weekend. So I think that's about all I wanted to say about the text. Let's get into it. Let's just go forward and see where we go. We'll get a little bit of this done before a break. I'll take a break in about 20 minutes or so. And then after a short break, we'll resume and continue on. I put this wonderful little photo again that I found on the internet of His Holiness the Dalai Lama there with 1,000-armed Chenrezig, or Avalokiteshvara is the Sanskrit word for this Buddha. This is the Buddha of compassion. And so this is going to come up in terms of this homage. Every text pretty much starts with a homage. The traditional Buddhist texts, they had a way of kind of delineating what the text is on the basis of what the homage is. But in this one, we get a homage to actually three things. Lama Atisha first pays homage to great compassion. Great compassion itself is not just the mind of compassion that we all know. You know, we all have some measure of compassion in our lives. And I would say even probably the people who have very, very hardened hearts still might have some compassion for their dog or cat or for someone very close to them. But compassion is essentially starts off with the simple wish or thought of others not suffering. Of course, we can direct it towards ourselves as well. There's nothing wrong. And we did that in the meditation tonight, right? Beginning with having a deep compassion for ourselves and our own suffering. In fact, they say this is an essential part of being able to connect with the suffering of others. But compassion is essentially initially that wish that beings be free from their suffering. What develops it into great compassion is, of course, first, it goes beyond just the people that we're already close to that we can feel some compassion for. Great compassion, by its very definition, entails compassion for all beings. You are not excluding a single being from that. Moreover, you're not just wishing for them to be relieved of the suffering that they experience that's at the superficial level, but even the suffering that is evidence of the unsatisfactory nature of existence in its totality. That, you know, this involves the deeper understanding that those things that we have in our lives that bring us pleasure are what we call the suffering of change. They don't last. They don't have the ability to ultimately satisfy. And then there's the deeper level of suffering, which is the reality that we're under the control of factors that keep us in this cycle of going from life to life, never really being free from it until we create the causes and conditions for that freedom. So when we begin to understand the suffering of others at that level, this compassion isn't just about removing some portion of the suffering of others. You know, we do need to be aware of the grosser levels of suffering of others, because this is where our heart tends to initially open a lot. But we need to go beyond that and look at actually how beings are suffering at a much deeper level. So great compassion involves all beings, involves removing them from all forms of dissatisfaction, the three levels of suffering, the grosser level, the suffering of change, this more pervasive suffering that is the state of, that beings find themselves in under the control of their karma and delusions, these three that I just talked about. But essentially, it's also something more than that, because for the bodhisattva, they do not want to simply develop that thought as a wish, as sort of an idea. Well, wouldn't it be great if all beings, every single one of them, were free from all dissatisfaction? They take on this altruistic intention, this idea that they are going to be responsible for that. So this is where we talk about great compassion, having the flavor of protecting others from suffering. So when homage is paid to this mind state that precedes all of the bodhisattvas, all of the Buddhas, it's kind of by extension paying homage to all of them, because it's paying homage to the mind that gives birth to all of those beings. It's kind of interesting, the text we studied in the master's program when I was over there for the 7 years I spent over there, the second text that we studied, which is by Master Chandrakirti, called The Supplement to the Middle Way, he begins by paying homage to great compassion. And, of course, it's a wonderful text to study. I even have a little course I put together that's just about the introductory verses that gives you an exploration of the ways to look at compassion and work with compassion. But essentially, it is the source of all the Buddhas. So it is an object worthy of homage. We're talking about a mind, a state of mind that is the beginning point for developing our intention to benefit others. It's sort of what awakens our, it is what awakens our Mahayana lineage, our desire to become a Buddha for the sake of others. Because when we begin to get familiar with that mind of great compassion, we are then driven to do something about the suffering of others. Because it already influences us in terms of wanting to protect others. Well, then how do we do that? We do that by practicing the path to enlightenment and becoming a Buddha ourselves. Joining the ranks of the Buddha, we then will be fully qualified to help others, having been motivated by that great compassion. And great compassion starts even prior to the path. It is there throughout the bodhisattva path, and it's there in the resultant state of Buddhahood. So it's a very powerful object of paying homage to, because it is the source of all of this. It's the source of all the teachings that we have, because we wouldn't have these teachings had not the Buddha himself and all these great beings of the past been motivated by their great compassion. Then we have the next line, which is homage to the teachers, to the gurus. Well, how is it that great compassion sort of manifests in our lives in a very real way for us as our gurus, as those beings who are either on the path or who have developed themselves completely and are still, you know, attending to us and other beings in this world, are manifesting, if you will, in a form to help us? You know, the teachers are an essential part of our path. As many of you know from having studied the Lam Rim, one of the two preliminary topics before you even enter into the small scope and then onto the middle and the great, before you even enter into those, you first of all acknowledge that you've got a guru who is playing some role in your life. You know, whether that guru is somebody who's evident to you or whether it's just someone who's providing teachings for you in a more intermediate basis, we are all depending upon some level of spiritual teacher, some guidance at that stage of our game. And then, of course, we also acknowledge that we have this perfect human life that is so important in being able to use all these conditions of having met with the Dharma and so on, and the ability to practice the path to enlightenment. So the very first topic we study in the Lam Rim is the reliance upon our spiritual teachers. Well, Lama Atisha is paying homage to teachers because the teachers play such an essential role. And by teachers, I'm not talking about myself here, really. I mean, I see myself as a Dharma instructor, somebody to help give some teachings that help people to get familiar with the Dharma. Here, we're mostly talking about those beings that we would call gurus. We would call lamas. The Sanskrit word is guru, and the Tibetan word is lama. And they have this essence or essential meaning of those beings who can help give birth to our own awakened mind and develop us. Those beings who are already quite heavy with their own qualities that we can rely upon because they have what it takes to get us there. They already have something that from their side that they've developed that makes them a reliable guide. Anyway, I'm not going to go into all the teachings about how to practice in relation to a guru and that's all in the Lam Rim. But know that this is an important part of this homage. So we're starting with great compassion, the mind that is underneath the surface of all this. Then we have the teachers, the gurus, who are sort of the more instrumental form in which we can find that great compassion active in the world, helping us. And then, of course, we have the third level. The third level, in our translation by Thupten Jinpa, I think it says homage to the faith divinities. We don't use this term faith divinities so much. I don't know, again, you know, quite what to say to that. But there is something about kind of this idea of faith. In Alex Berzin's translation, he does have some commentary on this text that I have borrowed from, and there will be some passages I share from that. He translated that part, the third one, as I make prostration or pay homage to the Buddha figures, those in whom to have belief or faith, those in whom one generates deep faith. You know, we can already have, I suppose, some faith and great compassion because we can practice it. We can have some faith in our teachers because they're there with us. But these sort of Buddha figures, these beings who have fully developed, who are on the other side, who are there to be accessed and there to be relied upon equally, are also something that we need to have some faith in. And of course, this might take a little more faith to kind of understand that there is this force in our world, these highly developed minds that is the goal for all of us on this path to awakening. And we see that those are still active in the world, that they are actually a source of great inspiration and support in our path. But what's interesting about this homage is these three things come together then in the guru. You know, we look at Alex Berzin and his commentary mentions that this homage really evokes for him His Holiness the Dalai Lama as who we are paying homage to, because he is the essence of all three of these. He, of course, is what great compassion looks like in terms of a mind that manifests day in and day out in our world. His Holiness acts from great compassion all the time, everything he does, every day of his life. And then, of course, we see him as a teacher, a guru. Many of us, we've taken, you know, great teachings from him, perhaps taken tantric empowerment with him. So we see him as sort of the embodiment of those qualities in our life. And we have the understanding, based on the way that His Holiness is known within the Tibetan culture and communities, that he is the reincarnation, the emanation of this Buddha that we know of as Avalokiteshvara, or Chen Rezig in Tibetan, the Buddha of compassion. So we see them as inseparable. It's kind of an interesting, you're paying homage to all three, but all three come together in that great compassion is there together with our teacher, and with our teacher there is also Avalokiteshvara, you know, is also the Buddha present in that being. Of course, again, when we get back to the Lam Rim teachings, they inspire us to develop the confidence that we are actually being led by Buddhas. And that gets to be a whole other thing to explore, but I'll just throw out a thought that may help you to get your head around that. You know, if we say that we ourselves are on this path through the three levels, we want to eventually become a Buddha, well, we have to complete the circle. How do we ourselves, when we achieve Buddhahood, help other beings? Well, you have to look at your life now and say, how am I being helped by Buddhas then? If Buddhas are still around and they're doing what they need to do to help other beings, well, where are they? How are they manifesting in the world? Because I wouldn't want to become a Buddha and then find out that I can't manifest in any way and help others. I'm just going to kind of hang out in Buddhaville with all the other Buddhas at the Buddha bar. You know, that would be a ridiculous goal to achieve, right? If you're a Buddha, you're motivated by great compassion to benefit all beings. So there has to be a completion of the circle. How do Buddhas help sentient beings? What's the most obvious way that they would help beings? Is to teach the Dharma, to teach the Buddha's teachings that help them, help those sentient beings to attain their liberation from their suffering, their enlightenment in the state of Buddhahood. So it makes sense that we would have Buddhas in this world. And if we look at the world at large, as I said, it must be our spiritual guides who are playing that role. I don't see our political leaders playing that role. I mean, some of them have been a little more enlightened than others. But nonetheless, you know, are we going to find those beings playing that role in our world? Not so likely. Are we going to find them as the heads of our corporations? Are we going to find them in some other role in society? I mean, it's not to say that any of those beings couldn't be a Buddha, because Buddhas can actually manifest in whatever form is necessary for aiding sentient beings. But where are they most likely going to be? In the form of our gurus. So this homage is a really interesting one because it's already quite grounded in Mahayana, but it's also got a tantric underpinning because, of course, when you start saying the sort of Buddha figure or the faith divinity, these sort of Buddha images that we get empowered into and that we begin to practice, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is renowned for giving the great empowerment of 1,000-armed Chenrezig of Avalokiteshvara. It's a very wonderful way to make that kind of tantric connection with him and to practice seeing yourself as that Buddha with 1,000 arms going to the aid of all beings and so on. So anyway, this is maybe I'm saying a little more than I need to, but it's worthwhile spending a bit of time talking even about the homage, because the homage has a lot more to it than just a few words of saying, oh, I praise this, I praise that, you know, whatever. It's really an important part of sort of setting up the text and the theme of the text. Because again, we're looking at a bodhisattva's path, a bodhisattva's way of going about practicing the path to enlightenment. So let's get into the first verse. Now, again, with each of these, I'm sometimes leaving the verse intact, but sometimes I'm dividing them up into a few lines. And when I do that, I put in this lettering. So A and B, of course, refers to the first two lines, and then C, D would be the next two. There are a few verses that have five lines, and one I think even has six, maybe two or three have six. But know that that's how I'm doing that in terms of the lettering. So we're in verse one, the first two lines of that. And Lama Atisha starts off by saying, discard all lingering doubts and strive with dedication in your practice. So you go, oh, that sounds good, you know. What could I say about that? But there's actually a lot to say about this, because when we first look at those first four words in that first line, discard all lingering doubts. What we are getting at is the necessity for each of us to remove what doubts we might have about the entire path to enlightenment. So I'm going to talk about that for the rest of tonight. No, that's not true, but I am going to talk a bit about bodhicitta because it's a Mahayana text, the main emphasis is on our commitment to making sure we remove any doubts we have about bodhicitta, its effectiveness, the goal of Buddhahood, the fact that we can do this. You know, sentient beings always struggle, I'm here talking mostly about the people of this world, especially the people of this side of the world, do struggle so much with some lack of self-confidence, some feeling like, well, this is great. I mean, I'm hearing all this stuff about Buddhahood, and I'm hearing about how I can achieve enlightenment through this path, but I'm not so sure I can do that. You know, we have a lot of sort of despondency within us, and this is even going to be talked about in a number of places in the text. But we first have to really develop the confidence that everything that we are talking about is an attainable goal, is something that if we put our time and energy into, we actually can accomplish it. So we need to remove our doubts initially primarily through study, through coming to understand. This is why the Lam Rim is a wonderful text to go to, because it gives you all of the main teachings of the Buddha so that you can understand how to practice them, how to meditate on them, how to incorporate them into your mind, and begin to generate some confidence that the process makes sense. But we're going to mostly focus on the process around bodhicitta and the desire to become a Buddha for the sake of others and gain a little bit more grounding in our understanding of that so that we can discard all doubts. We can, you know, hopefully, maybe not tonight or even this weekend, but over the course of our spiritual study and investigation, we can come to have that confidence that this is a result that we can attain, that this does make sense, that this is achievable. So what I'm going to do in terms of before we have a short break, we'll do this about 5 minutes or so, is first to go through very briefly the techniques to develop bodhicitta. this is a mind that we are not acquainted with right from the get-go. Now, of course, if you've studied and meditated on this mind in prior lives and you come into this life with great imprints from having done that, well, then maybe you can achieve bodhicitta much more quickly. But for most of us, we need meditations to frame the mind in terms of that thought. Bodhicitta itself, once more, is a mind that is intent upon achieving enlightenment. But it's not achieving enlightenment as the main goal. The main goal is actually to be able to help others. But we recognize that in order to do that, we have to develop ourselves. The analogy that I sometimes use for this that I find helpful, maybe you'll find it helpful, is say there's a young girl who's grown up in a family where there was a lot of cancer and people who died from cancer as well as had to suffer from that during their lifetimes and so on. So she becomes very moved as a young girl to want to do something about cancer. So she makes a commitment at a very young age that she's going to pursue this path, but she recognizes that at, you know, 6, 7, whatever, you know, age she is, she doesn't have the capacity to help other people with cancer. So then she makes a determination she's going to fully engage in all of her studies, especially science and all the things, physiology and biology and all the things she needs to know. And, you know, pathology, and she develops her mind through all of her education. She finishes her degree and she goes on to postgraduate studies or whatever, develops all this knowledge so she can become a cancer researcher or become an oncologist, whatever the case might be. But she knew that she wasn't qualified to do the work until she went through all of this education, all of this development. So this is the same for bodhicitta. We initially start stirring our mind of great compassion. As I said, that was what we paid homage to first. We begin to have this wish to benefit others. That gets developed first, and then we have the thought after it, well, I need to become a Buddha then to help others, because I don't have the capacity to help others currently. You know, how can I help others in my life right now? Well, maybe I can give some money to the homeless person on the street, and I can, you know, try to help in my, as a volunteer in my community or doing whatever, but I can't help all beings. And even the beings that I start to help or have some influence on in this life, I can't bring them all the way to the fulfillment of their true potential, to enlightenment themselves. I have to become a Buddha to be able to do that. It's the same thing as that young girl recognizing that she has to become fully qualified in order to help others with cancer. So again, this is one analogy that I find useful because just resonates with me, makes sense. So in order to, you know, kind of get the mind firmly in place that we need to move us on that path to be our motivation, we do have to engage in some techniques to develop that. So what you see on the screen here are the three main techniques that are taught. The first one is called, this is what I call it, the 7-point cause and effect technique. The other one is the instruction on equalizing and exchanging self with others. And then we have the 11-step combined method that sort of takes the best out of the first two and puts them together into a sort of a total process. So the preliminary step for developing through the first two, at least, because it's part of the combined method, the preliminary step before either of those first two is developing equanimity. By equanimity, we mean being able to not have a bias towards certain beings. Normally, we divide, and this is quite natural for us to do this, the world of beings into three groups. We even meditated on that a little bit in the meditation tonight when we developed compassion. We have the group of friends or people who are dear to us. We have the group of strangers that we're, you know, we don't know them. They don't really have any direct impact on our life. And then we have the challenging ones, the difficult ones. Well, the problem is we have a bias towards these three. We have great attachment to our friends. We have a huge indifference and a sort of blindness to the reality of those strangers. And we have generally some aversion, anger, hatred, even, you know, more complex feelings towards the enemies, the difficult people. Well, these attitudes get in the way because, once more, with great compassion as well as bodhicitta, and I mentioned this earlier, they're about all beings. Well, how are you going to make this mind of compassion the same for all beings and hold them all in that if you, first of all, don't even think about them equally? You haven't equalized your own mind. You haven't brought yourself to a state of even-mindedness with regard to these three groups. So again, there are techniques to work with this. Tonight's mission isn't to go through all of the individual meditations within this. It's simply to explain the steps. So first, you have to level the playing field. You have to get everyone as an equal object of your own regard. not so that you become sort of blah to all of them, but rather that you see all of them as worthy objects of your love and compassion. Then we go on in the first technique, in terms of working with that, to, in the first few steps, to kind of really feel a sense of closeness to others and a recognition of the ways that they have been kind to you. This will cause you to feel much greater connection to others. You know, right now, one of the other complicating factors is, even though we might have equanimity, we don't feel such affection for everybody who's in those three groups. We have a lot of affection for the people in the friends group, but we don't necessarily have it for the strangers, and certainly don't have it for the enemies. Well, the first step is to recognize that every one of these beings has been very dear to you in one life or another. Since you've had beginningless rebirths, you've always needed a mother. So the mother is set out in particular, because it's a very powerful archetype in our culture. But the reality is that everyone has been your mother. In every lifetime where you were born of an egg or a womb, you needed a mother, right? You know, there are some places where you have spontaneous rebirth and you don't need a mother there. But in the realms that we are dealing with in our existence, we see that beings come into existence through the kindness of their mothers. Mothers playing a very central role in terms of the care of their young. Even in the animal world, we see this. So then, having seen that all beings have played that role, you know, so that we feel some sort of affection already, we then begin to remember their kindness. And of course, if we think about the kindness that our own mothers of this life extolled upon us, if we had that experience and can recall that experience, but even if we can't recall that experience, we can think that most beings actually do, in the role of mother, put a lot of attention on their children, their offspring, and care for them. We see this in the world at large, again, in the animal kingdom. And then we develop the wish to repay their kindness. Because if we've received kindness, we should have the natural wish to reciprocate. So again, there are much more within this, and that first step is a doozy. It's a long one of meditating on that to get clear that every being's been your mother. But we frequently even use that term, mother sentient beings, as a way to remind ourselves that every being has been very dear to us, as our own mother, our father, our sister, brother, grandmother, grandfather, you know, whatever. Then we go on to generate these two thoughts that are central to bodhicitta. Having kind of brought those beings into a bit closer proximity to our hearts, we open up with this great love, which is the wish to place all beings in happiness and the causes of happiness. Again, it's got that altruistic intention already, but it's going to develop that even further in step six. Step five is the other side, the flip side of that, looking at the situation beings are in terms of their suffering. And here, generating not just compassion, but great compassion. As I said earlier, the wish to protect others from suffering, the desire to actually be the agent by which they know happiness and freedom from all the causes of, freedom from all the causes of suffering. Freedom from suffering and the causes of suffering. So great compassion is focused on the suffering side, great love on the happiness side. We then go on in a special step here where we develop this pure, superior, altruistic intention, where we think, even if it is by myself alone, I will do this for all beings, and I am committed to the path of accomplishing this. You know, it's sort of a deeper level of commitment where we not just have the thought of great compassion or great love, but the actual commitment to doing whatever it takes to accomplish that, to place all beings in happiness, to free all beings from suffering. Because we see them as our kind, mother sentient beings. That results in bodhicitta, because we come to the conclusion that we can't do this in our current state, as I said earlier. There's just no way that I can be fully dedicated to the welfare of others and accomplish it in my current state of mind. I haven't developed myself completely. I don't have the skill, the ability. Therefore, I have to do that, just like that young girl who recognizes that she really wants to help others with cancer, but she can't do it right now because she's only 6-7 years old and doesn't have the full education that is required to know the science and get involved and work with the medicines and the research and whatever else is involved to help do that. So again, this is the first technique. The first technique is much more about bringing beings into a sphere where we see them as very dear and close because we see them as having been our mother. And then we cultivate love and compassion. As we're going to see in the second technique, love and compassion are there, but it's a slightly different way of working with others because the target of that meditation is a little bit different. Okay, these breaks go by really quickly, but maybe not as necessary. We'll have some breaks over the weekend as well in the 3 hours. I'll figure out what that's going to look like. But let's go ahead and get back into the other technique for developing bodhicitta. Again, recognizing that this is a state of mind that we have to become more familiar with, and we actually have to cultivate it to a very deep level, as we're going to see in the second part of verse one, sort of overcoming the obstacles to having very deep concentration that will allow us to be able to make that mind very firm. So the second technique, again, is I'm going to put that up on the screen shortly, but let me give a little prelude to that. In the first one, we were really looking at this idea once more, feeling that sentient beings are very close to us, very dear to us, which is an important part of our path when we have to sort of have our hearts open to all beings. But in the second technique, it's said to be a little bit more of an intellectual technique or something, but it's essentially looking at one of the most problematic minds that we have, according to the Buddha, which is the tendency, even though we might feel kind of good about others, is to still fall back on what we call our sort of self-centeredness, our self-cherishing. I touched on this earlier this week. This is a problematic mind. Why? Because it ends up focusing on our own welfare, much to the detriment of others. Because we end up getting preoccupied with ourselves and with what we need and putting ourselves first. It's like we've elevated ourselves up to this high degree, and then everyone else we see as sort of servants of ourselves, kind of helping us to have what it is that we seek and what it is that we want. And this can even take place at a very, very subtle level, they say, this mind of self-cherishing. And that's at the mind where somebody, although the Buddha taught a path, certainly, for those who just simply want to be liberated from their own suffering, they don't want to become a Buddha necessarily. This is what we call the Hinayana path, the path of the individual vehicle. The Mahayana is the universal vehicle where we want to be embracing the welfare of all beings and be dedicated to that, as we're seeing in these this instruction on bodhicitta. But those who have their mind oriented towards the goal of their own liberation tend to even have a very subtle form of this self-cherishing. Well, for the bodhisattva, this is a real obstacle, a real enemy, if you will. So whether it's happening at a grosser level, the way that we all go about our lives, trying to take care of number one, me, myself, and I, it can manifest even in our society and, you know, ways that we tend to take care of ourselves and the people we love more so than the other countries or the other people that are in the world. And it manifests at this very subtle level, even on another Buddhist path, the path to one's own liberation, because when one is intent upon achieving that, we often, again, don't even consider the idea that we might be able to benefit others to a greater degree. So I'm hoping things don't cut out at some point. I'm hearing a lot of rain coming down here, which I'm delighted to see because we haven't been getting so much, but I'm hoping that won't entail any break in the connection here. But if it does, I'll come back in as soon as I can. Let's go back to the slides, and let's take a look then at this second technique. The second technique is called the instruction on equalizing and exchanging self with others. So the tendency we have to put ourselves first and others second, we're now going to try to equalize it, see us both as sort of worthy of happiness and so on, but then eventually bring others to the forefront and think of them first, sort of exchange the attitude we generally have towards ourselves to have that now for others. So the very first step is to equalize oneself and others by seeing that we're all in the same predicament, similar to what we meditated on to some degree tonight, that we all want to be happy, don't want to suffer, and that everyone still is suffering. Everyone is still dealing with problems and difficulties and isn't really happy yet. So it's a bit of an extension of the equanimity meditation, but it does have its own flavor. The second and the third are where we actually look at the disadvantages if we continue to be narrowly focused on ourselves, and the advantages if we learn to cherish others. Of course, it's said that karmically, this is how everything good comes into our lives. If we only think about ourselves and operate from that place, chances are we're going to engage in a lot of non-virtue. We're going to end up stepping on others and harming others in our, you know, rush to get to our happiness. If we cherish others and have actions that follow from that, then we create the karma that is going to result in our own happiness. This is why, as I mentioned the other night, this is the way to actually be wisely selfish, is we begin to recognize that our patterns of cherishing ourselves and thinking this is how I'll take care of myself as being solely focused on me, myself, and I doesn't lead to any positive results because we end up creating a lot of negative karma. Whereas if we are focused on others, this is actually how we get things in our lives and have good health and have all the various things as well as attain enlightenment. It's, you know, a necessary part of our path to sort of shift away from that self-centeredness to being other-centered. And this is, again, why we are going into this in this technique. But we have to go through a whole process of seeing the faults of continuing to do what we've been doing and the advantages of actually exchanging self and others, learning to cherish others much more deeply than we currently do. So let's go back into the steps then. The next step is then the actual thought to do that. It's sort of an intermediate step where we sort of look at it and we go, okay, well, I've seen the disadvantages of self-centeredness, self-cherishing. I see the advantages of the other. I'm going to be committed to doing it. I'm going to actually work on, you know, techniques to help me to remove my tendency to be focused on myself and begin to focus on others. And of course, the main technique to do that is what's taught in the fifth step. The meditation of Tonglen, or taking and giving. Tong, T-O-N-G, is the giving part of it. Len is the taking. But it's usually done in the order of taking and giving, where we visualize, and you can do this in a number of ways. I won't get into all the detail on this tonight. There's many people that provide instruction on Tonglen out there, sometimes each with their own flavor. But we want to have this process of thinking that we are willing to take on the suffering of others. Through our vision of compassion, this motivation of wanting to remove the suffering of others. You know, no doubt those of you who've been parents, but even, you know, people who've had pets that were sick, or friends, acquaintances, partners, whoever it was that was sick, parents that were sick, you know, you might have sat at the bedside of any of those beings when they were sick and really had that wish that you would take away their illness and experience it so that they wouldn't have to. That's what this taking on the suffering of others is like, but you want to be willing to expand it to be able to take on anyone's suffering and all beings' suffering. And then giving, the tong part of it, is giving away your happiness to others through the power of the motivating vision of love, kind of being willing to give everything that you have so that others can have happiness. All of your resources, your health, your merit, the positive potential you've created through your good karma, you want to give it all away. So this is a very powerful part of this. Essentially, it is mirroring what we did in the previous technique around great love and great compassion, but doing it with this very powerful process of Tonglen. After you've engaged in that for a while to really develop your compassion and love, then you go on to once more develop the pure, superior, altruistic intention, recognizing that you're going to be dedicated to doing this for others. While it's very powerful to do it as a meditation, you actually want to be able to remove the suffering of others and take, you know, give them your happiness. Of course, we can't physically always do that or actually do that, but we want to have that type of driving motivation that causes us to think we are dedicated to that. And we will do that even if it's by ourselves alone. And that results in bodhicitta, because once more, in order to do that, you have to become a Buddha. How you put those together is you start with equanimity, which was a preliminary step. Here it becomes the first step. The next three are right from the technique of seven-point cause and effect. They're the first three there of seeing beings as one's mother, remembering their kindness, wishing to repay it. And then we go into the three steps that we saw on three screens ago, equalizing oneself and others, and then thinking about the shortcomings of cherishing oneself, the advantages of cherishing others. We take out that one step about the determination to make the exchange. That's not put into this one. We go right on to doing taking first. It becomes its own step. And then giving, the ninth step. And then the 10th step, the altruistic intention, and the 11th step, bodhicitta. So it's very nice once you become familiar with the two techniques individually to combine this in this way. It becomes very tasty. But obviously, again, this is a process that we need to engage in repeatedly by going through all of the Lamrim texts that we can to study those steps, to really understand them. But of course, to do the grade school and, you know, intermediate school education that's necessary to support that. So as I said, this text is coming in at the sort of Mahayana great scope level, and there will be times when it touches on a few of the teachings in the lower scope or the middle scope, but nonetheless, it's primarily based on the idea that we've already checked up all of those and we already have great confidence in all those teachings. Now we're just going to universalize our concern and bring it to that level. One thing I want to talk about before I move on to talk about the latter part of this first verse, and kind of, well, I even got a little few things to cover before that, but the idea is how can we have even greater confidence that it's possible to achieve this? It's one thing to sort of study the meditation techniques and to begin to get a familiarity with them. I think we do need to have a greater confidence that it's possible to achieve Buddhahood through investigating. I'm going to kind of use a portion of what the Dalai Lama says when he teaches on this subject, because he points to a number of things that give us an understanding of why it's possible for you to become a Buddha, which once more is what this first verse is about. It's saying we have to get rid of all of our lingering doubts. We have to actually gain the confidence that we can do this. It can be accomplished. Well, the first thing he points to generally is that these deluded states of mind that we are trying to remove on our path. You know, we have minds of hatred. Let's say hatred, for example, as the one that we can call our negative state of mind. And then we have the mind of loving kindness that is opposed to that hatred. Hatred is not always present in the mind. I mean, I'm hoping none of you have hatred right now. Maybe you're developing hatred towards me, but if you are, that's okay. But I'm just, most of us don't have hatred in our minds right now, so we can say that it's not something that is firmly rooted in our minds. Otherwise, we would have hatred all the time, right? It's only occasionally there. It's impermanent. It arises on the basis of various causes and conditions, and then it goes away. Our mind calms down, you know, after some episode, and we go on and we are affable and getting along with everybody, and then something happens and the mind of anger or hatred arises. But it's not there all the time. That's already speaking to some potential for it not to be there at all, is because it's arising only at certain times based on causes and conditions. Another thing that His Holiness points to, though, of course, is that when we compare these two minds, loving kindness, love towards others, and hatred towards others, we can see that hatred actually doesn't have a stable basis. For one thing, it has to arise within the sphere of ignorance, the ignorance in particular that is at the root of all of our suffering, which we will touch on over the weekend, but won't get into it so much tonight. But I've touched on this earlier this week already. The tendency we have to be focused on ourselves as having some sort of fixed identity, a sort of substantial identity to who we are, an independent identity. This is a fictitious. We are making up the sense of self and we are acting from that place. In order for you to have a mind of hatred there, that needs to be there because that's the basis upon which I get hateful towards other people because I think that they're threatening this sense of self. If I didn't have that sense of self, if I understood the very subtle way that the self actually existed, I wouldn't have any of that revulsion of that person, any need to defend myself in the face of whatever's going on. All of that would fall away because it's not being upheld by any concrete sense of self that it's rotating around, that is fixated on. Whereas loving kindness can actually still be generated even when one's free of that, even when one has the wisdom that realizes that the self doesn't exist that way. Again, we're going to explore some of this idea of emptiness a little bit later, the I and other phenomena lacking that strong sense of this self, an identity from its own side, an independent identity. But loving kindness can be supported without that mind being there. Right now we have loving kindness with that mind because we just haven't removed that ignorance yet. At least I haven't. You know, so we will have some sort of mistake to that mind. But loving kindness in itself is a completely valid thought. It's looking at beings who don't have happiness, wishing them to have that happiness. It's not sort of, again, all rotating around this deluded sense of self. It's an actual factual thought about how sentient beings are and how we would ideally like them to be. Whereas hatred, again, is wanting to do things that are going to be harmful to that person and mess up their life because they've messed up ours or whatever. It's all rooted around a strong sense of an I that we're defending at that time. The other thing, of course, that His Holiness always points to, too, is that when you have both of those states of mind in opposition, which one will win? If you have the one that is not grounded in reality, that is not factual, and the one that is grounded in reality, that is factual, this one wins. In the end, through our own reasoning consciousness, we can bring to the forefront everything that is in accord with reality and defeat everything that is not in accord with reality. Moreover, all of these positive qualities like loving kindness, compassion, and so on can be developed to an infinite degree. you know, our bodies have physical limitations. We can't do certain things with our bodies as much as you might want to. You know, I would love to fly, but, you know, I haven't been able to figure out how to fly with my hands only, you know, my arms. You know, I can flop my arms outside for as long as I wish, and I'm not going to get up off the ground. You know, we do have limitations in terms of what the body can do, but the mind has no real boundaries. The mind can expand these qualities to a limitless degree. Now, we're not talking about the brain. Again, with mind, we're talking about a phenomenon that is non-material, that works in conjunction with this brain and this physical body that we possess, but has its own sort of continuity and identity, if you will. So again, this is some of the things that His Holiness points to that give us some confidence that because these minds are temporary, that are deluded, because they aren't grounded in reason, whereas those minds that are loving kindness and what have you are grounded in reason, that these will defeat those minds. The mind of wisdom will defeat ignorance. Ignorance, therefore, can be removed completely. Wisdom can be developed infinitely. So this is the logic that His Holiness points out. But of course, to gain some confidence in all this, to get rid of our lingering doubts, we do have to meditate on bodhicitta. We do have to become familiar enough with it. And that's what we're going to go to with the next two lines of verse 1. But I wanted to share with you just a few quotes from Master Shantideva. Again, Master Shantideva predated Atisha. What I'm going to be doing throughout this course is, some of these were in Geshe Ngawang Dargye's commentary on this text. Some of them were in Alex Berzin's. Some of them are just ones that I pulled that I think would be relevant to what we're studying. But look at how Atisha was influenced by people who came before him, and how he also influenced the whole Kadam lineage that followed in Tibet, these great masters who were great Kadampa Geshes, who were able to continue this lineage all the way to the present time. So there's a few verses from Master Shantideva that talk about how we need to gain this confidence that we can attain enlightenment. He has, this is in the chapter on joyous effort, enthusiasm for our practice. He says, oh, but how could I become enlightened? This is that, you know, nagging part of our mind that thinks somehow we're the unfortunate ones that are never going to become a Buddha. Even though everything I just said, you know, even though you can remove all the delusions, all what obscures the mind, it's still other people, but not me. Don't excuse yourself with such despondency. The Buddha who declares the truth has truly spoken and proclaimed that if they bring forth strength of perseverance, even bees and flies and gnats and grubs will gain supreme enlightenment, so hard to find. It's not saying that as a fly or a bee or a gnat or whatever that you will actually attain enlightenment, but that consciousness that is in that physical form has the same potential to become a Buddha that your own mind does. It doesn't have all the conditions to make that actualize, but nonetheless has the same potential, what we call our Buddha nature. A mind in which all of that can happen, the mind can develop to that degree, removing all of what is obscuring it, developing all of what is beneficial for it and for others. And if by birth and lineage of humankind, I'm able to distinguish good from ill and do not leave aside the bodhisattva deeds, why should I not attain the state of Buddhahood? So I love these verses, and they're very inspiring to read, you know, occasionally just to remind ourselves that we need to get rid of any of the doubts that are in the way that keep us from being fully engaged in our practice, because bodhicitta will get you there, and the goal is completely attainable. We have everything that we need to practice this path. It's just up to each of us to do it, you know, and we have to have that confidence that we can. Let's go on then to verse 1CD. And by the way, I will stop, maybe try to stop maybe 10, 15 minutes before the top of the hour and see if there are any questions. But in the meantime, if questions do come up, feel free to put them in the chat box. The rest of verse 1 says, thoroughly relinquish sloth, mental dullness, and laziness, and strive always with joyful perseverance. So this is the recognition that, once more, all of the qualities that we want to develop will come to us primarily through meditation. And there was another quote from that book on Atisha that talks about how, actually, I could read that right now. It's not a bad one to insert here in terms of what we're talking about, that we do have to have a very deep meditative practice in order to further our progress on the path. It says here, Atisha spent the summer in Yerpa to the east of Lhasa. Maybe I don't need to read all that part. It says here, a person from Yerpa named Shangtsun Ogurbar had great reverence for Atisha and requested instruction. This is much later, of course, in Atisha's life when he's actually the teacher and not receiving instruction from all the other great masters he had. So he's able to disseminate that knowledge. And Atisha said, son of good family, life is short. Objects of knowledge are many. Since the measure of a lifetime is only ignorance, you should meditate. Realization is abundant through meditation. There is not much realization through study. You should make essential exertion for accomplishment in meditation. Now, he's not denying the importance of study. He's just saying that if you only study, and of course, this happens with a lot of people in Buddhism, right? You study a lot and you gain all this knowledge and you can pontificate about all sorts of things in Buddhist teachings, but you've never really developed the inner awareness of these. You've never really brought it home through meditation on the cushion. This is where, again, I mentioned the other night about how we have two essential forms of meditation. One is to make the mind stable, like what we did with the breath tonight. The other one is to analyze these teachings. And this is where we would bring in those techniques to develop bodhicitta, is on the cushion. And sure, you think about them throughout the rest of your day, try to keep that awareness going off the cushion. But we really do have to do the work on the cushion. You know, and as Lama Zopa Rinpoche said at one of the Light of the Path retreats, I think it was the first one, Lam Rim is the real meditation. You know, everything that is set out on those three scopes, which again, Lama Atisha refers to bits of it in this text, is the real meditation, is what we need to meditate on. We need to analyze these teachings, think about them, cultivate the qualities that they're intended to generate within ourselves. This is the gist of these teachings, and if we only use them from the point of view of studying them and we never develop them, they say it's kind of like, you know, knowing that you have a really good medicine to solve your illness, cure your illness in your medicine cabinet, but you've never taken it. You know, you have great confidence that it's the best medicine in the world to relieve your illness, but you've never tried it. You don't know the state of being free from that illness. You know, no matter what your confidence is in the medicine is there to relieve your suffering. You know, and to help you to, you know, help others through being able to, you know, get that medicine to them. So it's a good analogy for once more how we can't look at these teachings simply as something we admire and have good faith in at a level of knowledge. We have to actually take them deeper so that they become more of what we call wisdom. That wisdom develops through three stages where we listen to the teachings like we're doing tonight, you know, and read teachings, bring things into our sphere of experience, and then we have to think about them. And that's the second step of developing wisdom. That is mostly what our analytical meditation is right now, is to actually reflect on them, contemplate them, pick them apart, analyze the various things that are set out in every one of the Lam Rim texts. And then we gain a greater conviction in them that eventually becomes the third wisdom, the wisdom that's due to our deeper meditation. And of course, to get to that, you have to have a very stable mind. So what Master Atisha, Lama Atisha, is going into in the second part of the first verse, he's saying, okay, get your confidence in bodhicitta, but then you also can't just simply have that awareness through study and reflection at that level. You have to actually bring it home. You actually have to bring it very deeply into your mind. In fact, it said that you don't technically become a bodhisattva until you have at least a level of what we call calm abiding, or very close to calm abiding, you know, for some practitioners. Calm abiding is set out in the great scope as a way of developing deeper and deeper meditative concentration up to the point where at calm abiding, you can abide on a single object for as long as you wish with no disturbance. You know, so right now we abide on the breath for maybe like a couple of seconds and then our grocery list starts popping into our head and then we go back to the breath. It's very interrupted. They get to a place when, and this is practitioners like you and I, apparently we've developed this in many lifetimes from what all my teachers have told me, but we didn't use it in this way. We didn't actually combine that stability of mind with developing realizations. So we do all of our study, but we have to eventually bring it home with this deeper level of awareness. And even for bodhicitta to be there to that degree where it becomes very spontaneous, where we don't have to go into all these techniques of developing it, where it arises naturally, you need to have deep meditative stabilization. Now, again, I'm not trying to discourage anybody by saying these things. We don't need more despondency and more thinking that we can't do this. We all can do this. You know, there may be some people who have a bit more obstacles to meditating than others, but we all can dedicate ourselves over time to this path of learning how to work with our minds in those meditative practices. So in that verse, we are looking at some of the obstacles that we need to overcome if we are ever to develop this mind of calm abiding or deeper levels of concentration. We have to get rid of sloth, mental dullness, laziness. These are the sorts of things that are interfering in a the way of sort of dragging us down. There are also some forces that are generally taught in the Lam Rim teachings around calm abiding, where the mind is going out sort of excited by various objects. But these are the ones that many people experience when they begin to meditate, and even can experience it for some time as they develop their meditation practice. This sort of sloth or sleepiness, this is the tendency that we have when we sit down to meditate because we're sort of letting go of all the external stuff. We're going inside. We get very tired, you know, and the mind becomes almost asleep. And sometimes you'll see some people meditating and they keep nodding off and then their heads kind of jerking up because they realize they've been sleeping. It can also manifest, though, as something subtler, which is a mental dullness, a sort of foggy mindedness, where the mind isn't quite as sharp and clear. And of course, one of the initial things that keeps you from even getting on the cushion is laziness. Laziness, we can actually see in the Buddha's teachings as being of three different types. And all three are bad. They say the worst one is the third. But the first one is that sort of, in Santa Fe, we call it the mañana mentality. You know, I'll do it mañana, you know, it'll happen at another time. That's that sort of laziness. It just keeps putting things off, procrastinating. You know, it's not a very good habit to have, right? You know, we just have to say, okay, I know I'm a bit tired and I know it's not good, but I'm going to sit and meditate anyway. I'm going to do it because I know I need to do it and it's an important part of my practice and it's going to help me and it's going to help others and whatever. All these rationale that we use that keeps us from going to that place of procrastinating. The second type of laziness, though, is our preoccupation with all the mundane things that we get involved in. I like to call this the laziness of busyness. You know, we all have so many things in our lives that preoccupy us that we feel like, oh yeah, oh, it's been really important that I write that email to that person. It's really important that I text this person on that. And it's really important that I make sure that this is happening. And we spend all of our lives sort of preoccupied with all that stuff. And we don't make time for our spiritual practice because we're attached to all that stuff. We really like that, you know. I mean, some people may not like some aspects of the busyness of their life, but we sort of, you know, gravitate towards that. You know, the cushion doesn't seem so appealing when we've got all those things to do. And of course, it can take the root of some things that are maybe even, you know, not so productive at all. But if we're attached to those kinds of activities, that's a form of laziness, according to the Buddha, because there's the only thing, reason why you're doing that is because you're not making a concerted effort to do what you should be doing in place of those mundane activities. The third one is what we talked about earlier. It's actually called the laziness of self-defeatism or despondency, where we somehow think, well, yeah, everybody talks about attaining these great levels of meditation, but, you know, that's just not something I can do. Well, who says, you know? Again, the Buddha says we all can do this. That verse from Master Shantideva, even gnats and worms and whatever, you know, they can all become enlightened. They all have that potential. It's just a matter of doing the work. So once more, why aren't you doing the work? You're putting it off on that when it's really just a form of laziness. So again, this sort of sloth, this sort of mental dullness, laziness, all of these can become great obstacles to our meditation. So we have to be quite clear when they begin to arise, when they start happening, to avert them with thoughts that oppose them. And of course, the main thought that opposes them is this joyous perseverance, this enthusiasm for our practice, which is fed to some degree by our awareness of bodhicitta, our feeling inspired by that, our knowing the path and knowing, you know, having teachers in our lives that inspire us, that make us want to follow in their footsteps and do what they, the instructions, the advice that they give us. So there's a lot of factors that feed into this. and a lot of powers that can be about that. I won't go into everything involved in developing joyous perseverance or enthusiasm, but know that it is even one of the six perfections of a bodhisattva. It's the fourth perfection that is so necessary if we're going to go on to develop the fifth perfection, which is concentration, you know, that stabilization of mind, and then the sixth perfection, wisdom. So it says there, strive always with joyful perseverance, and keep in mind that it is joyful. You know, I think I mentioned this the other night that one teacher I had said, if we're practicing Buddha's teachings and it's not fun, well, we're not doing it the right way. Maybe that was the teachings I did last weekend that I mentioned that. But nonetheless, it should be joyful. We should feel really good about what we're doing. Our spiritual practice should be exciting to us. We should really look forward to our Dharma study, our meditation, our going to teachings. We should feel like incredible joy. So I want to share a few bits from, again, the book that you could also pick up that would give you some commentary, though I'm going to touch on some of the points from that, certainly, that is out there, published by Wisdom as well, is Advice from a Spiritual Friend. It's two teachers, Geshe Rapten and Geshe Ngawan Darge, that provide commentary on a couple of different texts. The one who provided the commentary on this text is Geshe Ngawan Darge, who was one of Alex Berzin's teachers as well. He's passed away a number of years ago. But he says, as Jason Kapa, who again is the founder of the Gelugpa tradition that we follow in this branch of Tibetan Buddhism, the FPMT, and the Gelugpa tradition, he said, wear the protective armor of enthusiastic perseverance and increase it like the waxing moon. You know, that the more that we feed that kind of enthusiasm for our practice that's joyous and fully engaged, we have to just keep feeding it, and it just becomes its own force of, it's like inertia, you know, that something that is moving will keep moving, something that is stationary will stay stationary. You know, the idea being that we just want to keep feeding it so that it becomes self-generating, and we eventually can rely upon that to the greatest degree. Also, Chandrakirti said, all profound and superficial goals follow from enthusiastic perseverance. With it, anything can be accomplished. You know, and this is really true. You know, the extent to which that we can actually, you know, cultivate that very deep enthusiasm for our practice, that will help us to overcome all the obstacles to accomplish all the goals that we are setting out to do. Let me pause here just for a moment, just before I take questions, I do want to mention that in the traditional teachings about attaining calm abiding, our very first of the five faults, I won't go into all of them again because you can see those in the Lam Rim teachings, but the very first fault is laziness. Why? Because that's what keeps us from getting on the cushion in the first place. But how do you overcome laziness? There's actually said to be four antidotes. The first one is faith. You know, you have to have some faith or conviction in these teachings and in what's going on and understanding that this is a path that will help you to get where you need to go and accomplish that goal of Buddhahood. Then you have an aspiration, a factor of aspiration that aspires to achieve that. Yeah. This would be like maybe, let's go back to the young girl or something, the young girl who wants to become a cancer researcher. Well, she first has to have some faith that this is a path that will lead to her being able to help cancer patients and so on. And she maybe even does a little bit of investigation at that young age to see if this is a path that she could follow. And then she aspires to do that. And then the third one is this joyous enthusiasm, this perseverance. Because once you have the aspiration, if you don't put any of that energy into it, it's like wanting to go somewhere but never actually making the steps to go there. The final antidote maybe doesn't have a corresponding thing in regard to the young girl and her, you know, education, but it is the idea that you eventually achieve this serviceability of mind, what's called pliancy. And body as well. They say your body becomes as light as cotton, and you just don't feel all the physical limitations that you did when you were meditating prior to that. And your mind becomes incredibly serviceable. And I haven't experienced this in this life, so I can't speak to the actual experience of it, but this is how they describe it. So know again that there are more antidotes to overcoming the laziness, but joyous enthusiasm is one of the main ones, because without that sort of energy, how will we ever, you know, develop an ongoing meditation practice and actually realize bodhicitta and get on the path, become a full-fledged bodhisattva, get your little, you know, be card-carrying member of the bodhisattva community, and then actually become a Buddha. So are there any questions or comments? I didn't check if there's anything in the chat box. No, nothing in the chat box. Anybody have a question or comment in terms of what I've talked about so far tonight?
I have a couple of questions.
Great, Virginia.
Okay. Maybe you just answered one of my questions, which is, what if you have a medical issue that keeps you from sitting up for a very long time? Can you meditate lying down, or is that... But maybe pliancy is what I need to aim for, but I don't know how to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe when you finally get it, you'll actually, we'll be able to, sit straight up with all that. They say that this is the ideal meditation, sitting up, and even in terms of like energy flow in the body, the sort of having the uprightness to it. But we also see, of course, the dangers of meditating when you're lying down, because this is what we do when we go to bed, right? And so there's a tendency for everything to kind of move in that direction. So if possible, if there can be a way to be at least a little propped up in terms of the head somewhat, may not be able to sit up completely, but at least have kind of that. But if you do lie down, the most important thing then is to make sure that the eyes don't start closing too much and everything start withdrawing too much to where you lose that sort of focus. But people can meditate lying down, and by all means, if there's no way for you to sit up comfortably for extended periods of time, absolutely you can. I would assume, based on what I've heard, that you can develop probably pretty deep levels of meditative concentration doing that. It's just going to be more challenging because of that tendency for the mind to go into sleep mode, for the senses to withdraw and for that not to be, that level of attention. Meditation, again, as I mentioned on Wednesday night, isn't just about relaxing. There is a relaxation that happens with the mind to where we're not so tight. But if that relaxation just kind of continues into where it just becomes dull and sleepy, that's no good. We want sort of this, we're always looking for sort of the middle way, the sort of perfect pitch between these two, having things somewhat relaxed but not too tight. There was that wonderful thing in the Little Buddha movie, right, where Keanu Reeves is the Buddha, Prince Siddhartha, before he becomes the Buddha, who hears the musician telling the other person how to tune the stringed instrument. And he's like, if you string it too tight, it'll snap. But if it's too lax, it won't play. Well, it's the same thing with our minds. We have to find that sort of middle way there. But the mind should feel very alert and attentive without being, really tight and excited, and also certainly not lax, that's the idea. So absolutely. Now, you had another question or two?
Yes, I had one more. In a previous teaching, I can't remember about water, but it was, it might have been having to do with karma, but anger can wipe out, it's our merit, all our good merit, mm-hmm. but bodhicitta, once you get it, you have it. It can't go away. Is that the way? Is that right?
It to some degree, yes. The realizations that you've attained, what we would call kind of the wisdom side of it, anything that you develop through meditative concentration, those things won't go away if you have those moments of anger that are described in Shantideva's texts, Chandrakirti's texts, other texts. And those usually are moments of anger that we have towards a bodhisattva, a high-level being, somebody who is higher level than ourselves in that way, and they become a very powerful object for us. And so our moments of anger towards them can have destructive ability in terms of our merit. So yes, the sort of merit side of it, that whole part of our path, can be diminished to a large degree by those states of mind. But the sort of realizations that we develop, even though bodhicitta kind of has both aspects to it, but certainly if you develop any meditative abilities in this life, they are not subject to that kind of deterioration. We're mostly talking about consuming the merits that we've created that are sort of in our storehouse of merit that are not going to come to fruition because of those moments of anger. Yeah. So absolutely, by the time you become a card-carrying bodhisattva, you probably have pretty amazing patience with others, and you might not get angry so easily. But nonetheless, they even say on the bodhisattva path, you don't perfect your patience, at least get to a place where you can be really stable in your patience until you're on the path of meditation, on the second ground, the third ground of the 10 grounds. Anyway, I'm getting into maybe more technical stuff than I need to. It's pretty far along the path before you really have that stability to where the thoughts of anger won't arise at all. So know that, again, it can be very damaging, but in my understanding, no, it doesn't get rid of the realizational kind of components of our experience that we've developed. Yeah. Thank you for those questions. Very good. And again, back on you know, anybody who's dealing with any difficulties with regard to meditation, I'm even finding as I'm aging, I've got one knee that isn't particularly liking to sit in meditation posture these days. So I have to be careful with that and just do what I can to, you know, move that leg out when I need to and make sure I brace it properly and do all the things that are, you know, part of that. We're going to be dealing with these physical bodies, you know, for probably a while until we develop pliancy and have, you know, more lightness to the body. But don't let it become an obstacle to you. Don't let it become something you become too obsessed about. Rather, just kind of work with it as best as you can and keep doing the work. Yeah. So was there something else in the chat box? Share the slides on bodhicitta? Absolutely. I even the slides last couple nights that I did, I haven't put together a little file on them, and I'll work with Donna on how we might do that. I could certainly, you know, make them available. I do have a website. People can write to me there if that's the easiest thing. I can send them out. But I don't know, did you want to address this, Donna, right now? Is there a way for you to be able to post slides or make them available?
Yes, I can make them available.
Okay.
If you can get them to me, then we'll
make okay. them. So that will be the easiest way. And so if what I could do is certainly after tonight, I can put together the file with just tonight's slide. And would you prefer them all in one file? Do you want to wait?
It makes sense to me to wait, but okay. Yeah.
Let's just wait then. I will get them the entire course because I may end up adding a few slides, and I put slides together for all this, but you never know. I might decide to throw something in based on questions I'm getting or what have you. But I'll put all of it together into a PDF file and get that to Donna, and she can make sure everyone receives that. Okay, good. Any other comments or questions?
Edgar has his hand up. Go ahead.
Oh, yes, yeah, Fernando. Fernando, yes, good to see you.
I have heard in the past that you can lose bodhicitta. I don't know exactly when you're going to lose it anymore. I don't know if it's on preparation or the accumulation path. After doing something that you don't lose it, but there's a certain time in which you can.
Right. Yes, there is. And in Virginia's question, as I interpret it, was mostly about if you have those moments of anger, would they destroy a realization of bodhicitta? But in terms of what you're saying, absolutely, Fernando, there is some instability to bodhicitta only on the very first path, which is the path of accumulation. There are five paths that the bodhisattva goes through developing their minds: the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and then finally what's called the path of no more learning, which is Buddhahood. On the path of accumulation, there are three levels. There's the small, the middling, and the great. On the small level, your bodhicitta is still subject to some deterioration. But what they say there is it's usually a deterioration away from the goal of the Mahayana towards the goal of the Hinayana. So one kind of loses that bigger scope picture and decides that one wants to practice the path leading to one's own liberation. So it's generally not something that's influenced by anger or anything. It's not that, you know, those moments of anger cause one's bodhicitta to deteriorate and you fall off the bodhisattva path. But it's only at that level. Once you get to the middling level of the path of accumulation, your bodhicitta is said to be quite stable there. They use these analogies for it. There are 22 similes for how bodhicitta develops along these five paths at various moments as you develop your mind. That's beyond the scope of, again, what we're going to talk about here. But absolutely, yes, you're right, Fernando. There is a period of the path where they say you have to be very careful and tend to your bodhicitta very well so that it doesn't deteriorate before you get to that next level. And that's why we just always want to emphasize, like we do in that prayer that we recite frequently, right, about may this bodhicitta that has not developed arise and grow, and that which has developed increase more and more. So thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, that's a good clarification on that. Any other comments or questions? Okay,
Willis has his hand up, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not seeing Willis's hand. Okay, I see the little blue thing now. I'm sorry. Yes, please, Willis.
You're fine. You was talking about the various kinds of laziness, and I was like, has he watched me in my house? Because it's like here lately, and maybe you can help me. I do go through all of those, all three of those. But here lately, it's like every time I go to sit on the cushion, it's the wrong time of day. I'm either nodding off and I cannot stop yawning to meditate and take it seriously, or every time I can't quiet myself down and I'm trying to follow my breath, and it's discouraging, especially here lately. I have not been able to even feel like success in any form, and it's discouraging, and I'm like, maybe I need some help.
I guess one of the questions I'd have for you, Willis, and maybe we can talk offline at some point, or, you know, you can arrange some ways to, you know, talk a bit more about it, because I just went with the time elements and what have you. I don't want to go too deeply, but I would say that one of the things too is to really watch the duration of your sessions. You know, a lot of people, when they sit down to meditate, are simply meditating too long, and so the focused attention can't be sustained for that long. I remember it was Pema Chodron, I think, in one of her teachings, she said that when she did her first meditation period, she remembers hearing the gong, you know, go off, and then she sort of went off into space or something, and she remembers hearing the gong go off at the end. That was it. That was all that happened for her. Was everything in between was a wash. She has no idea where her mind was or what was going on. But I think we have a lot of that where we just started sitting down for too long of a period, and so the beginning and the end we might feel a little more attentive to, but in the middle, we're losing it. We're just not staying present. So I always encourage people, and I don't know how long you've been a meditator, and even if you have been a meditator for a while, we should consider ourselves kind of perennial beginners to some degree. There's a nice thing about that kind of beginner's mind. Even, you know, if you have been meditating for a while, try it just being within very short periods of time. Now with, you know, all these devices we have, you can set up something where it'll go off at, you know, a couple of minutes, 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 3 minutes, whatever. But when you kind of bring the time down to a much shorter degree, you feel like you're getting better success with it, because you only have a limited amount of time that you have to stay attentive. But then you keep elongating it, you know, work with 5 minutes for a week or two, and then change it, you know, to maybe 8 minutes or 10 minutes. And then eventually you get it to, you know, 12, 15 minutes, whatever. You keep elongating it so that you have a strength of mind and a confidence in your practice of having experienced what it's like to be focused the whole time, or at least most of the time. You see what I mean? And so I always encourage people to go there, and I don't know if that's something you've tried, but that was my initial suggestion. And as I said, beyond that, I think all the traditional things that they say, and like Kathleen McDonald's book, How to Meditate, about what to do if you're too sleepy and lethargic, you know, the sorts of things that elevate the mind, or if you're too excited and distracted and the things that sort of bring the mind down, those are all set out in the texts, and I don't know that I want to go hashing through all of those tonight, but know that they're also worth trying. And sometimes it's the physical stuff that really helps. Sometimes we really are tired and we need cool air. We need, you know, a kind of more upright stance. We need to have, you know, splash some water on our face. That may help us to be more attentive. Or if we're too excited, maybe again, we need to be attentive to things about our posture, maybe agitating the mind too much, bringing things in a little bit more, not being so outwardly focused. But these are the things that, again, I generally suggest just go back to the basic teachings that are given. And I think these are applicable for all of us as we continue to work with our own meditative practice. So did that help some, Willis?
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Okay. And again, if you do need to contact me, I mean, I'm not plugging my website. I don't have anything that great at my website. It's just a bunch of pictures of me with my schedule kind of half out there. I don't know. There's really not much out there. Some links to videos, but they're old at this point because I'm not really working on my website. But know that I do have one out there at donhandrick.com, and people can reach me through there if you would like to ask a question after these classes or even during. But anyway. Shall we conclude for tonight then? And if you do still have a question, please write it down. Don't put it in the chat box now, because that won't be there tomorrow, you know, but write it down and you'll have an opportunity to ask it tomorrow. Okay, so turn it over to Donna for the concluding prayers.
Okay, and let's say the prayers in English. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra too realized with a dedication praised as the best by the victorious ones thus gone of the three times, so I might perform good works. And now short long life prayers. First for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig, Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. And for Sarah J. Kinsarin Rinpoche, Jetsun Lobsang Delic, the one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience to receive the name Awatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. And now for the long life of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And for our precious Geshe's long lives. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Donna, and thank you all for joining tonight. And again, we'll resume 1 o'clock your time tomorrow and have about a 3-hour session. Again, we'll have a break or two in there to make sure you're not sitting for that whole time in front of a screen. But I'm very much looking forward to the rest of the weekend, hopefully exploring the entirety of this text. But as I said, we'll get as far as we can and hopefully learn some good things about our bodhisattva path and how to make it active in our lives. So, all right, wonderful. Thank you all so much again. Have a nice
evening.
I'll see you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone. Bye.